Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
TalkSTL.com, real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the war room of the O'Keefe Think Tank, this is Real Spoilers, a very special episode. We should, you know what we
for
should
you.
Do?
Well,
yeah, for me.
This is the one where Joe's hooked on caffeine pills.
Yeah. We should play that that old CBS intro they used to do before, like cartoons. That'd be cool.
Dun! I like it.
We should do that.
Yeah. We just did.
I think
you're done. You're a Foley artist.
Okay. Well, thanks for tuning in. So we should probably back up and explain who we are, because if you're listening to this, there's a good chance this will probably live in two places eventually.
This will, yeah.
But initially, it's going to live as an episode of Zilch, which is a Monkees-related podcast. So for regular real listeners of Real Spoilers, you know that I'm a big Monkees fan. For Zilch listeners, I should let you know, nobody else in this room is a big Monkees fan. But not like I am.
No. I mean, but I was a big Monkees fan, and then I met you, and I was like, all right, back to the Beatles.
Yeah, you're like, I'm not. There's like no way I'm keeping up with that.
Yeah,
so, yeah. And
that's when people try to talk to me about comic books.
Right, precisely. Yeah. Like, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a good analogy, because I'm a comic book guy.
Right.
I got like 75 long boxes out there, and then Joe comes in, and I'm like, yeah, no, you got me.
And this is just like when people try to talk to me about Man of Steel.
Yeah.
I don't think silence.
I don't think anybody ever really tries to talk
about
Man of Steel.
We try to avoid that at all costs.
So
change the subject.
For the Zilch listeners, let me bring you up to speed on what Real Spoilers is. Real Spoilers is a podcast. Well, duh. And we talk about movies every week.
We're not filming this?
Yeah. No, we're not.
I thought I was going to make it big.
We have a YouTube channel.
And so every week we take a new typically a new release. And we spoil it for you. Basically, it's kind of like a book club for movies. It's an in-depth conversation about that week's movie. Mm-hmm. And we discuss it in a spoiler-rich environment. So you should listen if you either have already seen the movie and you just want to hear a conversation about it and see if other people feel the same way you do. And hopefully we say something funny along the way.
Hopefully.
Occasionally we do.
Yeah.
Or about one for 90.
Yeah.
Or if you're a person that just doesn't really care about that particular movies, or if spoilers just aren't an issue for you, then that's what we do. We do it week in, week out. We've been doing it for 2.5-3 years.
Yeah.
So, and occasionally when it's light week at the box office and there really isn't anything all that interesting, we do what's called.
We do a 2-minute episode on some piece of crap holiday movie.
We'll do a Real Spoilers rewind. So we did one on like Night of the Living Dead. We did one on The Sixth Sense. And so we spike those in from time to time. So this would be a Real Spoilers rewind in which we will tackle the film Head. That's right. This week, Real Spoilers.
Yes.
Talks about Head.
Nope.
Not going to make that joke. Yep.
Nope.
It's too easy.
It is too easy.
It's too easy.
Yeah. You don't have to go for the layup every time.
No.
Yeah. And plus, we're at a guest house. We don't know.
Right. We don't know what your threshold is.
I don't want to go there.
Right. So we'll do our best to keep it clean. So
we will.
Joe, we're talking to you.
Joe,
everybody looked
like
at one
I just
side.
Put my head down like I was.
You should.
Like, I know.
You should feel great shame.
Like when your parents find out that you did something really like crappy at school and you hope to avoid it at all costs.
Yes.
And
then they can't see me.
They get that phone call from your teacher and you hear your name bellowed. I mean, I'm just speaking from my personal experience from downstairs, and you're just like,
I'm in trouble. So before we go any further, we should probably go around the room and people can introduce themselves.
Hi, this is Dan.
I'm Joe.
I'm Kevin.
And I am Tom. This is also the part of the show where I do shameless plugs. I'll make it quick in case you don't make it to the end. Because if you don't make it to the end, it's pointless for me to plug it. But if you like what you hear, Real Spoilers exists in other places. RealSpoilers.com. We're on iTunes. You can go there and rate and review and subscribe and all that fancy stuff. All the same stuff that Ken begs for every week. We're begging for it for us. So there you go. So if you want to follow us on Twitter, at Real Spoilers, Real with two E's. Or on Facebook at facebook.com/realspoilers. There.
Meh.
There.
Wow. We got it.
Got it. So now we will dig in to the movie Head, which is a really weird movie.
Yeah.
And if that's what you want to call it.
Yeah. Dan had seen it.
Oh,
already.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Joe and Kevin had not. Correct. So it was.
So should we preface this by saying there is an age gap? Like, do you think that matters when it comes to this movie?
Fair. Yeah, that's probably fair.
Okay, so Kevin, you are
28.
I'm 33.
I'm we'll go chronologically. Yeah. This is Tom. I'm 45.
This is Dan. I'm 48.
Okay. Right. So Kevin and I, the monkeys were out of pop culture. Well, that's not fair to say.
We didn't grow up in the 90s with the monkeys.
Dan and I grew up with the yes. monkeys in the 70s. So
yeah,
monkeys fans talk about which generation of monkey fan you are. Like, are you first generation? And they normally tend to consider the 80s is the second generation because MTV grabbed the monkeys.
Yeah,
they did.
MTV.
That's why I'm saying we did not grow up.
What caused there was a major monkeys resurgence in the 80s.
I had no idea.
When MTV grabbed them, and I think it was a bar bet. I think they were like, I think MTV was so huge at that point, they just collectively walked into a bar and said, we can make anybody famous.
Yep.
Monkeys? Sure thing.
Let's do it.
We'll do it. And so they started running these monkeys marathons, and then the monkeys were just huge. I remember seeing the I had been a monkeys fan since like the early 70s when they were running in syndication on local television, and it was one of those things that you would normally only get in the summer because there's only there's two seasons, but I think it's like 58 episodes, like that. So they would run it in the summertime, right?
Yeah. Oh, you know what, you are absolutely the only reason I know you're right is because so here in St. Louis there used to be a local like public TV called Channel 24 is what it was.
Right.
And they would play. So they would not. The only reason I know this is they would play Super Friends.
Right.
And then the monkeys would follow it.
Okay.
Right. And that's how I was introduced to the monkeys. Yeah.
So back then the magic number for syndication was 100 episodes. They didn't come close, but they would run it in the summer because kids were out of school and it would last about 3 months. They'd cycle through them all and they'd be done. So like that's where I kind of discovered
it's kind of brilliant.
And it played well because it was fairly timeless as far as the plots.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I mean, there was some confusion sometimes, like you're looking at the like clothing styles or hairstyles.
Sure.
You know? And this is somebody who like I caught Benny Hill. I never knew that I was watching reruns of Benny Hill, and I just thought the people in Britain were way behind.
Yeah,
that's on their fashion. Because I'm like,
and they're fluoride.
I was like, what are they? What's up with the collars?
Right. But, So in the 80s, they grabbed the monkeys, and MTV did, and they were huge. And like I remember, so the monkeys on their first tour, it was the monkeys, and then Gary Puckett and the Union Gap and Herman's. It was sponsored by Chunky, the candy.
Oh, I was like,
not just like a fat kid.
No.
Right.
Chunkster sponsored this one.
Way to go, Chunky.
Yeah. And so it was an oldies package. It played Powell Symphony Hall, which,
interesting.
Even if you don't live in St. Louis, you can probably pick up on what that is because it has symphony in the title. It's where the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra plays. We're from St. Louis. We're doing this in St. Louis.
And right.
Just to bring people
now, this is the post-MTV.
Well, what happened was they booked that show. Right. And then in between the time they booked that show and it went on sale, MTV got a hold of the monkeys. So poor Powell Symphony Hall thought that they were getting an oldies package. And instead, they got kind of New Kids on the Block because like it was
such a strange comparison. But
it was like screaming kids that were like freaking out for the monkeys. Yeah. And it sold out in like 8 minutes. And I had tickets. I was sitting in the eighth row on the aisle. And because I ran out and bought my tickets, I was day one. I'm going.
Did you buy your tickets pre-announcement or? like, so they announced
there was,
so
how would I is, hub
yeah, so how would I buy a show before?
What I'm
announced?
Saying is like they pre, so they pre, announced that pre MTV
yeah
right so oh. Were you going before they got picked up by MTV?
There was
or?
Not a thing in the world that would have stopped me from going to that show.
Yeah. With you.
Like, okay. I mean, I was the guy that was scouring garage sales looking for old Monkees LPs.
And this
I,
was now who was coming? Now, this wasn't Boyce and Hart and Jones and
no, that was
Dolan's.
In the '70s. So like in the okay. in the this in was, like around 76, they did a small U.S. tour that actually played St. Louis. It played yeah. out at Six Flags. They actually reference it in the liner notes of their live album that they put out, that they had been booked to play Japan because the Monkees had hit Japan and it was huge. And Peter was indisposed. He said delicately, uh-huh. and Mike wanted no part of it because he's Mike. And so. So Davey and Mickey teamed up with Boyce and Hart, and it was called Dolan's Jones, Boyce and Hart, the guys who wrote them and the guys who sung them. And
okay,
and
which
so
is fair,
yeah. And so they did, because Boyce and Hart wrote like Last Train to Clarksville and I'm blanking, but like was Stepping Stone, Valerie. They wrote a lot of the big
yeah,
ones.
And yeah,
so,
yeah.
And so so they played in at the Six Flags.
The old glory
amphitheater, just as a warm up for the Japan dates, and shut down the highway. Like, that's how.
Are you serious?
Crowded it was. They held the record for park attendance until New Kids on the Block played there, like in 84 or 85, whenever they got
New
there.
New Kids on the Block played Six Flags?
Yes, yeah. And it was kind of similar in that they booked them, and then they blew up, and they were like, well, we're not going to get in. And it, again, shut down the highway. Everybody was trying to get in.
Man,
so,
that's crazy.
So, but anyway, so Generation 2 is considered the people that discovered them on MTV, where yeah. Dan and I guess, are Generation 1 and a half. We kind of fall in between.
I'm with you.
So, like, when the Monkees got big on MTV, I was like, well, maybe now people can stop making fun of me. Because
yeah,
like, I remember the first time I saw Monkees cassettes in the store, like, the only albums I have ever managed to find at garage sales were Monkees, More of the Monkees, and Headquarters, which was their first three. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they were still doing well, but the sales started to decline, so you didn't find them, you didn't come across them at garage sales as right. frequently. Used record stores really weren't that much in my peripheral at that, you know, at that yeah. You know, when I was
were
nine,
they a thing? Were they a thing? When you were
I guess they had to have
they,
been,
they
but I really didn't discover them until I was a teenager.
They were a collector's band,
right?
They were, I mean, and they were hard, especially like when they became a three piece, minus
Peter Leaves.
Like, it was
first.
Hard to, like, they still output music.
They
but
put
it was,
out two records without yeah. Peter,
and it was
and
hard
then,
to find them. And ironically, because the Doors did the same thing, they put right. out two records without Jim Morrison, and. They're not bad, but it was like
there's no Jim Morrison.
It's not really the same.
Right? Yeah. So I remember when they had the cassettes in the store, borrowing money off a friend because I thought I'll never see these again.
Right.
Which now seems silly, but I thought I'll never.
Isn't
see
that
these
weird?
Again.
Isn't that yeah. like we talk on our podcast sometimes about digital media,
right?
But like just the idea
they
that like
find
you
stuff.
Go into a record store in 1987 and you're like, it's right here. I'm never gonna see this again.
I better get it now. Like, somebody needs to loan me money.
2015, and, where I was like, I have Apple Music, so it's right there.
That
right.
is crazy yeah. because I remember we've talked in previous episodes about out of print DVDs.
Right.
And like, okay, I want to watch a movie and I cannot find it. This day and age, not being able to find
it's
something,
it's so rare.
It just we're
now,
not used
that
to
being
it.
Said, the Monkees have put out so many different versions
yes.
of like albums with different remixes and stuff that a lot of the stuff you buy through iTunes
yeah.
is mislabeled.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like yeah. for instance, if you buy the soundtrack to the movie Head, the version that they have of Circle Sky isn't the one that's really on the soundtrack. They have I think they have a different one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. But so you do run into that because there's so many they've culled the vaults so thoroughly on this band that sometimes when the people at iTunes are just like, whatever, yep, that's the name of the song, and they end up putting up some weird like radio edit
yeah.
or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So but yeah, so, you know, it's funny when talking about how weird it is to see movies actually segueing into the movie proper. The first time I saw this movie was like at an art house in town, a theater called the Tivoli.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a double bill. It was Hard Day's Night and Head. And like I remember seeing the ad in the paper. This would have been like 85 or 86. No, 86 or 87, because the Monkees had a revival at mm-hmm. this point. So but it wasn't at the time available on VHS.
Mm-mm.
And
okay.
like, so when I saw that I finally had a way to see it, like
I didn't know that I'd ever get another chance to see it.
Right. You were happier than a pig in poop.
Yes. And so, and it's just, I kind of missed that. You know what I mean?
I agree.
Fact that it's on my bookshelf and I can watch it whenever I want. But I also love that feeling of like, I have to make this an event. I have to go do this because when will I get to do it again?
It's
right, that excitement's coming.
Well, it's like a comic nerd. Like you have your Holy Grail list. And when you have it, you're like, I've got it.
Right.
And then you have it. It's like,
and then it goes in a box and you never touch it.
Never see it again.
Yeah, totally. So the movie itself, this, some background, the film came out in 1969, and they filmed it over the course of 68, and it was...
This is in between seasons, too, right?
They were filming it, I think they had finished filming the second season. I think the show ends up getting canceled while they're filming it, if memory serves. The monkeys going into season three, what they wanted to do was get away from the show that you're used to seeing, and they actually wanted to turn it into a variety show so they could kind of
play music
and bring in people that they liked. And you know, because you see that towards the end of season two, then you see Frank Zappa pop up, and you know, like, so they wanted to use it to kind of expose America to people that they liked, because you know they were cast in the show and they were chafing at the idea and the notion that they weren't a real thing, which is
that really was a thing though, right? Like people were just kind of like they're put together by a studio.
Yeah.
Like
correct.
Not, they I mean they were lumped into this whole prefab four thing. They were also lumped into like this pseudo rivalry with the Beatles, which never happened,
which wasn't a real thing.
Was not a thing at all, especially between them.
Yeah, the Beatles liked the Monkeys. They thought they were funny. And I'm sure it helped that they never really saw them as a threat.
Sure, well, nobody was really a threat.
Not to the Beatles. Yeah. I mean, it's not like the Monkees didn't have hits or sell or move product, but they weren't the Beatles.
It's the Beatles.
Yeah. I mean, like, it just wasn't, you know.
But you had two actual, real, genuinely talented musicians in the Monkees.
Right,
right.
Who wrote their own music. And then you had two really good vocalists.
Yeah, one who, you know, especially Mickey, who was, I mean... boy, do they get lucky with that dude. Yeah. I mean, he's arguably the most underrated vocalist of his generation.
He does pretty much all the heavy lifting on their vocals.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's funny.
I know Davey does like a couple.
You know, I've always found it interesting because people perceive Davey as like the face of
guy.
The group.
Yeah.
But if you go down the list of their biggest hits, so Stepping Stone, Mickey... I'm a Believer, Mickey, Pleasant Valley Sunday, Mickey, Clarksville, Mickey. Like the biggest hits
interesting
are sung by Mickey. And so like
Davy Jones like just the biggest like dreamboat? I mean, is that
why?
Yeah,
he was the one that the girls were crushing on. And he certainly sang on hits, don't get me wrong, but if you look at their absolute biggest hits, I mean, really his biggest hit is Daydream Believer, which I mean is just a perfect piece of pop music and perfectly matches his voice. No one else in that band could have sang that song, and I don't know that anyone else in pop music could have sang that song,
including the writer.
And totally, if you hear the original version, it sounds off, it's brutal. And so, you know, so it was just this perfect marriage. So they had been selected, the cast in this show, and then it kind of came out that they weren't playing on the first two records, because if you think about it, how could they?
Right.
They were making a show, they were doing appearances, they were like, there's all this stuff going on, and you want them to record albums.
Two albums.
Yeah. Like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And
but the band was put together for the show?
Correct. Yes. So...
Oh.
So they ran an ad.
But this is not like a Milli Vanilli thing. Like, the voices are the...
Right, they were singing.
Yeah.
Like, they were... You really heard them singing.
It's just so you don't get many Milli Vanilli references anymore.
Right. But,
yeah.
But
yeah.
They weren't actually, for the most part, playing, I think, like, Peter played bass on one track.
But I got you. They weren't a band that got a show. They were put together.
Correct.
For
they
show.
Were assembled. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so...
But they... Like, there was the voice of Dissent pretty early on, and Mike.
Yeah, Mike and Peter, because they were brought in with the notion, with the idea that they would be performing on these records. And they were showing up to the studio, and they were like not today,
man.
Not today, kid.
We got Clarksville and Daydream Believer. Sorry.
Oh, you want to play a song? That's adorable.
But they did end up giving them, like, one or two songs.
Yeah, like
token.
Yeah, like
songs.
Mike's got a song that he wrote on the first record, and you know, which was kind of to appease him. And I think Peter like plays bass on it. I'm not as good with like the deep like who played on what, like you know,
you're better than
but you could tell because it's like, wow, that that sounds a lot different.
Right. And so so their second album, More of the Monkeys, comes out. I'm afraid I'm boring the Zilch listeners because there's that they know.
You guys know.
But yeah. I got to bring you guys up to speed. So
this is like me doing a comic podcast.
Yeah. So the second album comes out. It's called More of the Monkeys, and it was released, and they hadn't even told the Monkeys it had come out. The way that they discovered that this album is released is when somebody handed it to them to autograph. And it was
I can picture me like, what?
That's an eye opener.
And Mike was like, the hell? And then the other thing that really upset them is the picture that they used on the cover was a photo shoot that they had done for a line of Monkeys clothing that was going to be sold at JCPenney. So it was like the biggest like hoard out, like, here we are in all our JCPenney like clothes. Kiss. And like, yeah, they were just like, they were like irate. And so that caused a revolt. And then they basically threw out Don Kirshner, who was the music director of the project. They put out, then they recorded an album where they actually played everything called Headquarters, which is, I think, their second. I think Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones is an overall better record. But
man, I love watching you nerd out. It's awesome. Awesome.
But Headquarters.
But Headquarters is amazing, and there is just this giddy sense of joy of like them just doing it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Just
and,
like kind of it's weird. Like, I don't want to call it punk, but like just that punk rock idea.
I will call it punk because the Monkees are what, you know, for all the crap they take for being like, oh, they don't play their own instruments and blah, like, these guys had the world on a silver platter. They had a huge hit TV show. It won an Emmy. They were selling tons of records. They were playing concerts, and they was getting paid. Yeah, they were making some serious jack, and they stood up and said, this is a load of BS. We need to play our own stuff.
That's punk.
And we don't care if it means we sell fewer records. We don't care if it means we make less money. Right. We want to have some integrity and some authenticity, and we want to make something real. And so as a Monkees fan,
that is punk. Yeah,
that's where I get frustrated when they're like, they shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. I was like, you know what? What other band has been in that position and ever said, I don't want the check. I want to do it the right way.
Any band worth their salt, especially in the Hall of Fame, is a band that started out as a cover band.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely.
It's just what you
That's
did.
How you start. Yeah. You know, you don't come out with Enter Sandman.
No.
No, you come out with, I don't know, Black Sabbath. You come out with some Diamond
Garage Days Revisited. Why did they put that
exactly.
out?
Exactly.
Like, that was the stuff they grew up playing. Yeah.
The Birds are a great example. Birds came out, they were a Beatles cover band.
Right.
And really, some of their greatest hits, I mean, the Birds are an amazing band, but some of their greatest hits are actually covers of Dylan songs.
And, yeah.
Interesting.
And the ultimate irony is, in the Birds, who are considered phenomenal, they weren't allowed to play on their records either. And you know who they use? The same damn studio musicians that the Monkees use.
Yes.
Like they were called the Wrecking Crew. There's a great documentary about it. It's on Netflix. Yeah. And like that, they use the same people play on their records.
Why the split?
Well, it's because it was so public.
Yeah,
and they
had this TV show, and there was just this pushback from the music industry that they felt like they didn't do it the right way. Like, they didn't go out in clubs, and they just had it handed to them. And, you know, and they didn't have it handed to them. Did they get a head start? They absolutely got a head start. Yeah. You know who else got a head start? The New Monkees. How'd that work out?
Yeah,
you know, and so I actually I'm not a fan of the show, but I think the music was great. Great might be too strong of a word, but I thought the new Monkees album was a really solid piece of late 80s pop rock. Like it was for the time period it came out, for what it was trying to do, for what it was going up against. I thought it was really good, but it got nowhere.
Well,
so
anybody who's been on the Mickey Mouse Club has had a head start.
Yeah, so there's all sorts of people. So there are all sorts of people who got a head start and capitalized on it. There are all sorts of people who got a head start and it went nowhere. And
right,
so,
you got to have the goods to back it up.
So the movie Head is created in this environment to where season two's wrapping up. They're really chafing at this notion of what they're supposed to be. They all want to do something radically different. And meanwhile, the guys who created the show, Bob Rafelson and Bert Schneider, they want to go make movies. And so they see the Monkees as their launching pad. But I think the problem that they have is that they didn't want to be tethered to the Monkees, right? So
So I was,
they wanted to make some sort of they wanted to make some art house film,
right?
But they also they wanted to get some distribution,
right?
So, some funding.
so they make this Monkees movie, and it's probably the greatest single act of career suicide I've ever seen.
Oh, like, good! I'm so glad you said that.
Like intentional. Now that being said, I think that this, for what it's attempting to do, is a good movie. Mm-hmm. But they really ended up making like a French New Wave art house movie.
I would completely agree
that
with
the
that.
Monkees happen to be in, and that really takes the whole surreal nature of this film up a notch.
I thought it, like, as I'm watching it, and I was like, I feel like if Dario Argento had gone like a little bit less hardcore horror and a little more like this way, this would be an Argento movie,
right?
Just so, from the colors.
Well, it's
and
like Jodorowsky. It's like El Topo or something.
Yeah,
at a
yeah,
point,
yeah.
You're like, what?
Yeah, what am I watching?
So let's get into the movie proper.
Yeah.
So we open with this weird bridge opening scene where if you had just wandered in, you wouldn't even know you were at a Monkees movie.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Like they go on for a while.
It was like the gag,
the microphone gag.
Yeah, the microphone gag was like something out of like a. Like
it's a very
like an Animal House or Blues Brothers, kind of, like a John Landis kind of gag.
It's a very of the moment movie too, because of the styling and the way it's shot.
Yeah,
and you know, it's just you could tell it's like, you know, there's sometimes you see movies they're timeless. This one's like, well, this
this is not a timeless movie.
No. It's not,
but I think that's ultimately to its benefit. It's very of its time.
Yes.
I think if they tried, you can't do a timeless version of this. And if you did,
I don't know what time this movie belongs in. Honestly,
I mean, it's clearly the '60s,
right?
Yes,
like, it's clearly.
I mean, I've seen a fair amount of films from the '60s, and it's like they have like that kind of trippy sing-song kind of like
it's got
like the kaleidoscope kind of
it's got that sort of documentary feel.
Yeah,
especially
that
opening scene where it's very cinema verite,
as the
art film crowd would say. So you see him trying to do this opening ribbon ceremony for a bridge. It just goes on and on, and then at some point the Monkees, led by Mickey. They just burst onto the screen, and like they're running a marathon, just sprinting, and they run to the edge of this bridge and they stand there, and then Mickey
jumps into the water.
Yeah.
So much for that National Guard they had there with their rifles, right?
Yeah.
So you've got the mayor or whatever politician that is doing this, and you see four random people running through the middle of it, and there's a bunch of armed guys there.
It's a bridge opening, it's not Kent State.
I'm just saying, like, what?
Just FYI, that is a drill team, because I was in a drill team in high school, and that's just like for show.
It's there was also that weird sound effect where like it was like every person in the drill team was like,
we had the chrome domes and we spun the rifles and did the whole thing. But they were,
and just because I don't know the time period, whatever, is there any significance that almost everyone was African American?
You mean everybody on the drill team?
I don't know.
At the bridge scene? I never noticed.
They went down the line
to
every single one. And
possibly.
I just noticed. And I'm just like, is that a telling of the time? I don't know what that meant.
You know what I think that might have been? There's a scene later in the movie where they come across a drill team, and I would refer to it today as a step team. And my theory is it might have just been a budget thing. They might have filmed those scenes in roughly the same time. And they just were like, we need you for 3 days. And like they already had them in their uniforms and their guns, and they just lined them up. Mm-hmm. But they needed them for this kind of step scene that they do later.
Well, that's what a drill team does.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
There it is.
So that's what
they
do.
So that's my theory, but I do not know
I mean, it's most likely a military school, and that's what they do.
So Mickey jumps in the water, and we get this weird called solarization effects.
This is the point where I was like, what is he making me watch?
That was a long fall. I'm like, he does good form on that. That was okay. Double somersault.
A couple times you're like, oh, that's a mannequin.
You mean when he hits the water?
Yeah. Cut him a little slack.
I know.
And you get the first song in the movie, which is Porpoise Song, which is an amazing song. I don't know what your guys' thoughts on that.
I had no problem with the music.
Yeah.
The music was fun. I had a blast with the music.
Co-written by Carole King.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Goffin and King.
Yeah.
And so that they were a writing team for a long time, and they wrote some of the Monkees. They wrote Pleasant Valley Sunday for the Monkees. They wrote Star Collector, Take a Giant Step, Sweet Young Thing.
Yeah.
And then other songs that this team had written for other performers. They wrote Up on the Roof. I'm Into Something Good for Herman's Hermits. You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman.
Yeah.
They didn't write that song, you. Joe. You Just Make Me Feel That Way.
Yeah. I'm so happy I could do that.
Yeah.
But yet, it's my nobody called out the Herman's Hermits.
Right.
Herman's Hermits for doing
the same thing. Or the Beach Boys. If you want Love and Mercy, they were using the same, that's the Wrecking Crew, it's the same musicians that the Monkees used.
Yeah.
The exact same.
I wonder why, like, do you think that's because of the TV? Like, the Beach Boys didn't have a TV show, Herman's Hermits didn't have a TV show, the Birds didn't have a TV show.
Right.
Do you think it's
because they showed them on TV playing.
Right. That's
but
what
you
I'm
would
saying.
See the Beach Boys would make it. But the Beach Boys could go out and do it live.
Yeah, right.
The Monkees would go out and do it live. Yeah. But eventually. But at that point, they had not. So, but anyway, back to Goblin King. Yeah. They also wrote Take Good Care of My Baby, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, Some Kind of Wonderful. So they kind of know what they're doing.
Yeah, I think they've got a niche.
Yeah. So, and this song was used in Vanilla Sky.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. By Cameron Crowe.
That's a weird movie.
Yeah. And it was also used, I think, towards the end of Mad Men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
yes, it was.
When Don was kind of having one of his final breakdowns, like, what is going on with my life? They play the Porpoise song.
This is a good song to point to as anybody who kind of just only saw the Monkees as bubblegum.
Right.
This.
They got some heart to it.
Is not.
Yeah. No. This song is covered all the time by a Polyphonic Spree, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
So, yeah.
It's very psychedelic.
In fact, I believe there's a version on YouTube where the Monkees went to England like last summer. Mickey and Peter, that version of the Monkees, went to England. And I believe somewhere on YouTube there's a version of Mickey singing this song with the Polyphonic Spree.
That's cool. Kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he gets rescued by mermaids because why not?
Yeah. Sure.
Right.
I mean, we're here.
Sure. Yeah. Like, you know, and
that's probably Jack Nicholson's contribution.
Yeah. Cause Jack Nicholson was involved in this movie.
Oh really?
Yeah. He was a writer. He's credited. He's in it.
I didn't.
Him and Dennis Hopper pop up briefly. Yeah. We'll get to that.
We will get to that.
So, so we get this scene with them kissing, which is funny because, like, I was watching this movie with my 9-year-old stepdaughter. She's happened to be in the room.
Okay.
And it's funny because she likes the Monkees. Like, well, I'll watch episodes with her sometimes, and she actually likes the Monkees.
Yeah.
And this shows you exactly what they were going for and the effect that it must have had for the 7 people that saw this movie in real time. Like, when they get to the kissing scene, she was just visibly disgusted at this scene of watching them actually because they're kissing for real. It's not like a TV show kiss where it's like
kissing.
It's the one woman.
Yeah, it's one.
Which is the other thing. I was like,
I believe she was Jack Nicholson's girlfriend.
It's
at
kind
the time.
Of w- w-
she's credited. In the credits as Lady Pleasure.
Yes.
Oh, excuse
it's just odd
me.
To see.
Are you talking about this is when he when we go to back to the real world
back to the Monkees
quote
pad,
unquote real world,
and that's the actual apartment from the show. They just took down some of the crazy signs, but it's the same place, the same set, and which I think makes it more disconcerting because when you see them in a setting that you're used to from the show, it's saying that these are the same guys. You know what I mean?
And they're all making out with this chick.
And they're all making out with the same chick. Like, it's like, whew, yeah. I don't think Last Train to Clarksville means what I thought it did.
Which would have been Davey, by the way.
It's also a funny scene because she goes from guy to guy, and then she gets to Davey, and the windows part, and the light of the Lord shines down upon them, and then. And then was it Mike, who's just like any man? So who wins?
Right,
gotta know.
Right.
Did I make you?
Huh?
And she's like, oh, it's equal.
It's fine.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Like, no, it wasn't. So then we could probably get we go into Diddy Diego War Chant, which is the song that kind of sums up what the whole movie's going to be about, because they talk about hey, where are the Monkees? You know, we love to please, a manufactured image with no philosophies. I do not have this written down.
I know you don't.
Sad. But they spell it all out for you. We hope you like our story, although there isn't one. That is to say, there's many, and that's the way there is more fun. But it may come 3-2-1-2 or jump from 9 to 5. Like, it's telling you, like,
yeah, it's laying everything out for you.
It's going to be a jumbled mess, and it's on purpose. And if you don't like it, you should leave now, which is what most people did.
Yeah. Yeah, this is definitely a deconstructed version of what people thought they were seeing.
Right. And what's really, I think, fascinating, and doesn't really get enough play, is that this movie initially was released for general audiences, and then later they put a stamp on it of, like, on the re-release of, like, not suitable for all audiences or something like that. But it was officially rated G originally, and
when that was somebody get shot in the head,
and it's a GD snuff film. Like, you see a guy get shot in the head.
That's
like
a good point.
Not even pretend. Like, you, this might be the only G-rated film in which you actually see
brain matter,
an honest to God death.
Yeah.
Like, they kill an MF-er on screen.
Yes.
Like,
I'm sure kids were like,
well, you know, my theory is, because I was watching with my wife, and she's like, how does, like, even now, nobody really talks about this scene? Or when they talk about it, they say that it's in there, but nobody even references the fact, like, this was ostensibly a kid's film, and you see a dude die.
Right.
And I think it's because it's such a famous clip.
Yes.
You know, that people just, it didn't even register for them what they were putting in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it just kind of goes right past you, because it's like, that's...
You've seen it so many times.
You've seen it so many times, you're numb to it, you know? So we get the little, like, I don't know, overture, our thesis statement of what this movie's going
to
be.
So I need to preface this. So I did watch this, and but I was watching it while I was at work. So, like, there are pieces I don't remember at all, because I had it on the background.
Well, I'm going to go on a limb
of movie
and say you're probably not the first person to watch this movie that didn't remember parts of it.
Well,
it's just yours was work related.
Yeah, I need to preface this by saying I watched this movie at home and I have no idea what was going on and will not remember parts. Yeah. So
did this really get a Criterion edition?
Yeah, that's what I watched.
I'm shocked. And you know, they've come out with some weird choices. And then when I saw that their logo on
it,
I was like,
that's a joke, right?
Like, no.
Granted,
Chasing Amy got a Criterion edition, so.
No, well, it's been, I think it sort of has a revisionist history now.
Sure.
They do a lot of
things in the movie, and the filmmakers went on to be incredibly important to the history of cinema.
Yeah, like the next movie.
And independent cinema.
I guess that makes sense.
Easy Rider.
Yeah, then I guess
so
that makes sense
kind
why
of
I probably got picked up.
That Monkey's Money helped out.
Yeah. Okay.
And they do stuff in this movie that you see in their other movie. For example, the foxhole scene.
Right.
That this goes into, where they send Peter out for ammo. And it's the whole thing about, don't wear your helmet, I don't need a helmet. And then... is it Mickey, I think, ends up wearing a football helmet instead of an actual helmet.
Right, yeah.
Can we think of anybody else in cinema who wore a football helmet instead of the appropriate helmet for the activity that they were participating in? Like, that's an Easy Rider. That's what they instead of wearing a motorcycle helmet, he wears a football helmet.
Yeah, that's
like
true,
Nicholson.
Yeah.
He's the one wearing the football helmet.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, you see, like, this kind of, these things that they're kind of already working out in their head.
Interesting.
Isn't there a football player that tackles someone out of nowhere?
They're on the battlefield, and he's an actual player for the Green Bay Packers. It's like Ray Nitschke or something like that. Sports. I only know it because it involves the Monkeys.
So they're on the battlefield, and this football player tackles them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I was watching this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can watch this as straight as can be.
Yeah.
It still feels like maybe
it's kind of
took some cold medicine.
It's kind of also trying to deconstruct the show, because you see a lot of things that, like, could work on the show.
Yes. Well, I was wondering
jokes or plot points.
And I was wondering, because I'm like, did they use some footage from the show? Because to me, it felt like they were almost referencing things you might have seen.
Right. And they use a lot of actors, like character actors, like the Sheik that you see later played a Sheik on the show. Like, you see a lot of the same actors, because they're kind of trying to deconstruct that universe.
Yeah.
And it's really maybe one of the first mainstream, if it had been a hit mainstream, but because of the inclusion of the Monkeys, I think that makes it mainstream. Like, examples of meta in cinema. Like, they're very much, this whole movie is essentially, it's what makes the movie work. It's what makes the movie work, but it's also what makes the movie inaccessible for guys like you.
Right.
And,
I see.
And that it's a very large end joke about the monkeys. And so the people that listen to Zilch, like,
it's them. Like,
they're gonna love it, or at least understand it in a way that you can't, because like they're really making a lot of jokes at the monkeys' expense about the monkeys and about the backstory of the monkeys. Like, it's not even jokes about the show. It's jokes about the fact that they don't play their own instruments, that they aren't who you think they are, that they've been told to be one thing and they really want to be another.
That's actually pretty. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I always dig it when acts or bands or actors or anybody in entertainment doesn't take themselves so seriously.
Right.
You know, like, I it's a dumb reference, but I feel like Bruce Willis is an actor who takes himself so gosh darn seriously.
Right.
That he did, like, so when he doesn't make, you know, he is John McClane. Like, in his mind, he is that character. Yeah. So, like, I appreciate it when, like, John Hamm shows up on SNL.
Right.
Auditioning to be Han Solo.
And it's funny you say that, though, because I kind of feel like this is that, but it also kind of isn't, because I think part of the reason that they did this wasn't so they could not take themselves seriously, but the goal was
people would take them seriously.
So people would take them more seriously.
Well,
they were trying to be like, we're not
and
this.
I think, I mean, this movie definitely kind of is jarring for anybody who only watched the show. Is like, Peter in this movie, I think, is the, I mean, I think he's sort of the catalyst of the movie.
Sure.
And he, I mean, flat out says, I mean, he's the furthest away from the character he played on the monkey.
Yeah, because he's probably the only guy on the show who didn't end up playing a version of himself. Peter Tork is not dumb or naive or stupid. He's none of those things. And I mean, not to be a name drop, but I've met Peter Tork many times and have the luxury of having very long conversations with him. There is nothing stupid about that man.
That's very
and he's like the only guy who really like had to play someone that's the exact opposite of who he was. And so I think that's always kind of bugged him, and I think it took him a long time to come to terms with that. Especially when, you know, they try to portray you. And I never saw Peter as the dumb one. I saw him as naive and trusting. And so people
the Joey Fatone of the monkeys.
And so people within the show context would exploit that aspect of his personality. But I never saw him as dumb. If that makes any sense. So after the foxhole scene, we get I go back and forth, but this might be my favorite monkey song, in Circle Sky. Mm-hmm. And this is not the version that's on the official soundtrack. You get a studio version on the official soundtrack, which is not as good. And this is the live version.
Yeah,
this is actually them playing it. Mm-hmm. And like, they are just tearing it up on Circle Sky.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's just,
it's loud. It's raw.
There's a clip where they cut to Peter, and I it's funny because it's like he's sitting there and he's playing his guitar. I guess it's bass. I'm not good enough about instruments to know, but
it's bass.
But since Mike was playing that big huge Gretsch, and I only know it's a Gretsch because I hear people talk about Mike and his Gretsch all the time. But I assume he was playing bass. That would make sense. But he's got his head down and his hair's in his face, and he's got that '90s grunge stance.
Yeah. Nice.
You know what I mean?
Awesome.
Like he's just like
he's
staring down and he's like hitting like that bass line just over and over again.
Right.
And I'm just like, man, this looks like this looks like Cobain or something.
Yeah,
like
it's just that's awesome.
I just found it fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
that's pretty cool.
But anyway,
he knew in that moment, he was also like, we're playing, this is, because that's Mike's song, right?
Mike wrote that song.
Yeah. So it's like, this is one of our songs. We got to do this right.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's one of ours.
Yeah. And so at the end of the scene, then the kids storm the stage and they tear apart, and then there's just mannequins, maybe the same mannequins that jumped off the bridge. I don't know.
Yeah.
But don't try to make sense of it.
No, don't.
And so there you get this. From there, we segue into this extended scene of Mickey in the desert and his Coke machine.
And we were talking about the soda.
Yeah. What's that? Yes, we're talking about the soda.
Making sure we're on the same page.
Because I don't think these guys would do drugs.
What?
I don't think that
much
seems...
Much like in real life, the Coke machine was empty.
Yeah. So, and this is another scene that, like, could have been in an episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of a straight-ahead, jokey scene, but because of all the stuff that surrounds it, it feels very surreal and odd.
On an episode that Tom and I did together because nobody else saw the movie and was here or playing Fallout 4.
Kevin.
I was in bed when you guys were recording.
Yeah, so, but resting up from having played Fallout 4 all night. But
we said
as you
that,
were. I got Fallout fever.
Ed Helms, when he took over as the Michael Scott character on The Office,
right.
They were recycling probably some Michael jokes.
Right.
So, like, is it possible that, like, these were scenes that they had planned? Like, did they know that season 2 was it?
I don't think they knew at the time they wrote this because I don't think that's what's going on because famously,
you know, what I'm saying is, like, I wonder if these were scenes for the show that they're like, well, we're never going to get to use them anyway.
I don't think so because this movie was famously written by Rafelson, Jack Nicholson, and the Monkees. They went to, I think, in some island or tropical locale, fittingly named Ojai. And,
and makes sense.
Basically just. As Bill Murray would say, got stoned with the bejeebies and babbled into a tape recorder.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's where the plot of the movie came from. So to the best of my knowledge, no, because
okay.
They weren't using the writers from the sitcom.
Right.
Because it would have looked like if they had used the writers from the sitcom, Head would have been the Monkees equivalent of Munsters Go Home.
That makes sense. Okay.
You know,
I can
and
that. Okay.
And clearly it's not.
Sure.
You know? Because this is that era when they were trying to take TV shows and put them on the big screen. So Munsters did it.
There was a Munsters movie?
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, Munsters Go Home. That's what I was
and
just talking about.
And it's so
Oh,
jarring.
I thought that was like a...
No, it was a
feature film.
It was color too, wasn't it?
It was in color. That was the selling point. Ooh. You could finally see the Munsters color. In color.
Doesn't work.
Doesn't work. Yeah.
No. And I don't think there was a laugh track.
No. And
also,
that's always been the problem. Like, whenever they do these sitcom reunion shows, I've always said that's the problem. Like, if you watch Return to Mayberry,
yeah.
It's actually not a bad Andy Griffith episode.
No. No,
there's no laugh track. So they would say these jokes and they would pause
and, then there's silence.
And hold the moment and there's silence and you just feel it. It's like those episodes, like, people post them on YouTube of, like, Big Bang without the laugh track.
Which is what it should be.
Which
is
realize
awful.
How unfunny the show
it's
is.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels like that and yeah. it's really weird and
interesting
so,
yeah
but yeah so
okay
they,
that's
they,
what I was
they were gonna
like
do
that.
It with they were gonna do it with Get Smart there was like a 3 or 4 part story arc in season 2 called a Man Named Smart, I think is what it was called, and
okay.
And they had written that to be a feature film, and then the Munsters did it and the feature film did so poorly the show got canceled, and so they were like maybe we're not going to do that.
I've made an error.
And then they just broke it up into a 4-parter, so or 3-parter, whatever it was. So anyway, so from the he blows up the Coke machine after he's stranded in the desert. And
I like that. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, you finally got a little action.
Yeah, I liked it.
And there was something kind of linear going on finally.
Yeah, well, no, it was funny. Yeah, because he's up on the Coke machine. He's hitting the stupid thing. It's like empty.
Yeah.
And then he goes up to this tank after all these guys have surrendered. I'm like, this is really weird. And he gets in the tank, but he turns it and then blows up the Coke machine. I'm like, yes, okay, that was funny.
Yeah.
Because, it's
right.
Going back to, okay.
Yeah, so then we get
which to me felt very... Mike Nesmith, because I also look at this as, like, if you've never seen Elephant Parts, check it out. But I also look at this as, because he is kind of one of the unofficial creators. Well, official.
I think they brought him in for MTV and they wanted him to be the program director, and he was like, "Well, that sounds boring."
Yeah,
and
but
he had
concept.
Was in on those early sessions, from the way I understand.
And
it.
And then they kind of went off without him.
Yeah,
but I mean, because this felt like something like
totally.
Like
if you
that.
If you watch Elephant Parts, it's a series of like little tiny sketches like that, and it. You know, I don't know that he wrote it, but they were all stone and babbling, so he very well could have. I don't know, but
it's the same. It's
if you like
the
that,
line.
Then
yeah.
Elephant Parts is probably more your speed.
Mm. Okay,
yeah. So from here we get our first Peter song. It's sang by Mickey, but written by Peter. It's called "Can You Dig It?" And that's who Peter is, right?
Right.
Can you dig it? Like that's who he is. Like
sure.
And so that's why in this movie he's more of what you was
in.
Yeah. So,
I'm with you.
So
I think about it as the guy from the Warriors.
What's that?
Like the main boss bad guy from the Warriors.
Yeah.
God, what is his name? Damn it. Okay.
Awesome guy. That's what his name is.
But so after Can You Dig It, we go into our Western scene. And Bob Rafelson had said that he didn't know that he'd ever get to direct another movie. So part of his goal with making this movie is he was going to film every genre he could think of.
That's pretty cool.
So you get a Western, you get a war movie, you get a boxing
movie. I'm
going
to get one shot at this.
Yeah, you get he's going to do everything. So
that's funny.
that boxing.
Well, you see, when they get to the Western, I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
So what? Why are we in a Western?
So you get a very young Terry Garr.
Is that who that
that's
was?
That's who that was.
Man, she was pretty. She was a pretty lady.
And she's been around forever. She was on, I think she was on an episode of Andy Griffith, wasn't she? Mm-hmm. She was on an early episode of MASH. Jack Nicholson was also on an episode of Andy Griffith, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
But
I thought the woman looked, I could not figure out who it was to save my life.
Yeah. But she has one of the lines that gets used. If you listen to the soundtrack of the movie Head, there's a lot of snippets from the movie. And so they use that
what
one.
Knockers?
The suck it before the quick suck it before the poison reaches my heart.
Yeah.
But at this point is when the kind of the wall of the movie begins to break down. Not that there was ever much of one, but Mickey has his tantrum on set where he's knocking the arrows out of his chest and he storms out and he breaks through the set.
I like that. Like visually, there's a lot of stuff in this movie. Just real quick to interrupt. Like, okay, the
podcast where we talk about a movie. I don't know that it technically counts as interrupting, but go on.
But you know, it's like, so there's no plot and it jumps around and the movie's crazy and makes no sense, but visually I'm like, they did a lot of stuff visually that I think really worked. Like I liked the direction, I liked, you know, I liked the performances even, you know, it's just it just was so disjointed and weird.
And they do a lot of like really quick edits that weren't all that common for the time. And what's really interesting is Rafelson has said that, like, because he did that as he went on with his directing career, he started using less edits because he felt like I'd already done that. And so he's like, I'm going to be more about the performance and holding the camera and letting the actor shine through because I've already done that. You want to see quick edits? I did it in Head. Like, and it's just interesting that as the rest of the world ends up in unintentionally, because I don't know that I could say this movie is influential enough to influence a whole generation of filmmakers, but as the rest of the world coincidentally follows the footprint of this movie with quicker edits, like
especially now,
like he's going the other direction and going with longer and longer takes. So I just thought that was interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah.
So then we get our first diner scene with the sassy transgendered waitress, female impersonator. I think you can just flat out say female impersonator first.
It's what it was.
It's 1968, and I think that's what that was supposed to be. I don't think it was supposed to be a statement on gender.
No.
This is
the one that I liked.
Yeah.
Where he's like, I don't think I should punch her.
Yeah. And there's, I think
and that's where Jack Nicholson appears.
I think the punching comes later, doesn't it? Because they go back to to the waitress. This is the one where they're like all talking about, they're all like, Davey has this really weird interaction with her where they just can't stand each other.
Right. Yeah.
And he's like, you know, I'd like a glass of cold gravy with a hair in it, please. And they're just like saying like really,
it was
like mean,
really
hateful
weird
things
yeah
to each other. But it's like, but it's like it in today's culture, like it feels borderline offensive.
Yeah.
But this man, woman, like, and I don't say that politically, like, I don't know what it is. I really don't know
what they
were trying to say.
But she can so hold her own that you don't, like, you feel okay about it. You know?
I was just like, what are they doing? Like, he's like, why don't we go get out of here so we can never run into each other again?
Right,
just really weird stuff.
Yeah,
like,
I liked that line.
What are they talking about?
And so then it segues into the boxing scene, and that's Sonny Liston.
It is,
who would be dead within 18 months.
Little did you know.
Yeah. But that would have been like it's like Mike Tyson popping up in Hangover.
It is, yeah.
That was a hit. People saw it, but you know. And then the actress is Annette Funicello.
Yep.
So,
oh man.
And so it's kind of more breaking down to the fourth wall because you see him picking the boxer, and the hand comes out and wipes her tear away.
Yeah.
And then, you have that extended boxing scene where Mickey flips out and runs up in the ring and starts punching everybody, and you get the whole like, you know, you're the dummy. And that's when Peter really kind of comes out as you know, and it's so like sad the way he's saying it, where he's like, I'm the dummy. I'm always the dummy. Yeah.
Right,
it's really kind of like, you really like have a lot of pathos.
You did
in that.
So I never knew, like, I just assumed, like, I didn't have the context of like, he wasn't the dummy.
Right.
You know what
right
I mean? So like, it didn't register until you said earlier where he's like, he was never that guy.
Well, yeah.
Right.
Well,
that
and
scene
and
means
I think,
more
I
now
think that whole, like, just pretty much all of Peter in this movie is sort of like the most deconstructed take on the monkeys as what they were, presented as on television.
Because also don't forget that, like, it's not like an actor has never played a dumb character before,
right?
But like, these guys
they casted them and then they gave them their own names within the context of the show.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really...
It's harder to disconnect the two.
Was, yeah, that's what really muddied the waters for people. That it was like, you know, like the actor's name was Peter Tork. The character's name was Peter Tork.
Like Tony Danza.
Yeah.
But he really was dumb.
Right. Well, yeah, fair enough. So then we get As We Go Along, which is another Carole King song, this time without Goffin. It was with another writer whose name I'm blanking on. But this is just a beautiful song.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, and they still do this one in concert. They do Porpoise Song in concert a lot too. It's just a really beautiful song, and you get guitar work from Neil Young. That's just okay. Who was doing session work back then.
Isn't that weird? Like, isn't that just strange when you hear names like that? Like, he was just a guy who didn't really get any work.
Yeah.
So they just brought in Neil Young
right.
to do like backup guitars for something.
Yeah.
And that just, I just always find that fascinating when you look at, like, there was a Sound City documentary.
Right.
Where it's just like they talk about, if you haven't seen it, it's a Dave Grohl documentary about a soundboard. And just all of these artists who have performed on this soundboard in this studio. But it's just like you see all these people who were like, yeah, I was there, and then in walked, you know, like Clapton or Fleetwood Mac, anybody who's
Jimmy,
like,
Page started as a session musician.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling.
Glenn Campbell was a session musician. In fact, he plays the main lick on Clarksville. That's what makes it so like vibrant. Like, he was in the Wrecking Crew. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I always find that, you know, people starting out where I was like, yeah, this guy guested on this spot.
Well, it's like getting your foot in the door. They
got it. Yeah,
there,
no,
then,
you're exactly,
you know,
like when they should, like,
Jennifer Lawrence was on the Bill Ingvall show, right? Like, wasn't
right.
She was?
Yeah.
Got her in a paycheck.
It's like all those actors that we see now, and then we go and watch a movie from 20 years ago, and like, what are they doing in this? Just
like Dana Carvey in Halloween 2.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
I'm not making that up.
Yeah. Brad Pitt was on an episode of Growing Pains.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis was an extra in The Verdict.
Huh.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he sits in the courtroom in that final scene. You see him in the background.
Yeah.
So after As We Go Along, which is a wonderful song, they're taking a tour of this factory.
Right.
Which, it couldn't have been attended, but it really looks like Amazon. Like, it looks like where Amazon would ship
right.
stuff. And there's a great line where the guy who's given the tour says, you know, your generation is just completely consumed with pleasure and getting exactly what
and
you
immediacy.
Want. And immediacy.
Wow,
and the tragedy of your generation, my friend, is you may get exactly what you want. And it's just like, and it's really prescient.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they were already thinking like, oh my God, the world is getting so crazy with how immediate things are.
And this
like,
is immediate and 60 standards.
Yeah.
And like, which was like, you know, it got there faster than like 5 days.
Yeah. And like, now fast forward 47 years.
That is crazy.
And it's just like,
exactly where
we
were.
Yeah, when he said that, I was like, whoa.
Yeah, like wow, that's really profound, especially knowing that they said it 50 years
ago.
Yeah,
it really was.
Yeah. So
the monkeys invented an Amazon, too.
Yeah.
So, check.
Yeah, that's just, they're very ahead of their time.
Yeah.
So then you get the weird dandruff scene where they
are in
their dandruff in Victor Mature's hair.
Yeah.
And the story is that Rafelson and Jack Nicholson, when they were stoned, Nicholson was saying something, going on about something, and Rafelson had just kind of zoned out. And he was like, what are you thinking? And Rafelson said, well, I'm trying to think of the darkest thing ever. And Jack Nicholson was like, well, what did you come up with? And he said, Victor Mature's hair. And and he was like, that's going in the movie.
That's awesome.
Sure enough, here we are. The monkeys are dandruff.
Yeah, because I was like, what is up with the Victor Mature?
There was there was a cut scene on SNL about 2 weeks ago where they were playing dandruff and they were dressed. It looked like it was... like somebody must have seen this movie or something. It looked just like it. I didn't get a chance to watch the scene,
which is weird because SNL is a really young cast.
Yeah,
like they're a bunch of pups and they're great.
Yeah, but
young kids.
So after this, you get Davey's kind of solo moment of Daddy's Song.
Yeah,
that's what it's called.
It's so Davey.
So Davey's Broadway
rock.
But that song is who else could sing that song? Do you know who wrote the song? Harry Nilsson.
Oh yeah.
Harry Nilsson, whose career was basically jump-started by the Monkees.
Yeah.
He was working at a bank, and he had written a bunch of songs, and he had done this kind of a Beatles edit where he did, like, put, like, 37 Beatles songs in one song, but it wasn't editing. It was him playing it And it's a really cool song, and it was kind of like, I mean, he basically like invented the mashup. I don't even know how else to describe it.
Interesting.
And and so it got him a lot of attention, but he wasn't really still earning a lot of money. And then he wrote this song and called Cuddly Toy, which is ended up being a pretty big Monkey song. I don't know that it was ever a big single, but within the Monkeys
catalog,
yeah, like sure, if you want to be normal, like it's still like that's like a marquee song for them, a song Davey would always sing in concert. And Davey bought the song like on the spot, and the story goes that that Harry Nilsson's manager was like, just turned to him and was like, "You can quit the bank now, like
you're all right,
yeah, like you're gonna be okay,
yeah,
yeah."
Right.
And so, so this is the And Mickey was actually really good friends with Harry Nilsson and part of the Hollywood Vampires.
I was going to say the Hollywood Vampires, and if you don't know about them, look them up.
Yeah, and that was Alice Cooper and John Lennon and Mickey Dolenz, and was Ringo one of them, and Harry Nilsson.
This is like the weirdest group of
friends. Oh, yeah. It was basically like you had to be able to drink a certain amount to get in.
It was a drinking club.
Yeah.
Okay.
And these were the guys.
Yeah.
And it's always weird when you hear like behind, when you hear the behind the scenes stuff where it was like it was this guy was friends with this guy and
right.
they were a tight group, but
people that are so different, like
when you said Alice Cooper and John Lennon
and then it's Mickey Dolenz and you're like what you're like normally I would say like get all Sesame Street and be like one of these things is not like the other, but none of these is like
none
the
of
other.
And then
like,
they were all and they were all
that's so cool
they were all enablers.
They all had their issues. But Daddy's Song, talk about editing. Like what
What
a brilliant scene from an editing standpoint. Because here's the deal: like there was no computer trickery because your computer was the size of Montana back then. You know, like they filmed that scene twice: once in with black clothes and a white background, and another with white clothes and a black background. And then they would go in the editing bay and just like toggle back and forth.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, Jesus, no wonder Rafelson didn't want to do quick takes anymore. Yeah. I can't imagine how many cuts there must be in that scene.
Because you have to actually cut. Like, there's no Avid where you
were literally cutting. Like, I'm surprised if more people had seen this movie, they would have given somebody a seizure.
Yeah.
Like, because, I mean, it's so flickery, you know? But, and the girl he's dancing with, I should point out, is a young Tony Basil.
Yep. Who is the choreographer?
She's the choreographer for the film, and if you know her, it's from her big 80s song, Mickey. Oh, Mickey, You're So Fine.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And a lot of people think that that song is about
Mickey Dolenz.
Well, a lot of people thought it was about Mick Jagger, and a lot of people were wrong. It's about Mickey Dolenz. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense now.
Yeah, that makes complete sense now.
Yeah. But yeah, so she was the dancer in that scene and choreographed all the whatever dancing is in the movie. So I guess the belly dancing scenes and stuff like that. So Davey gets done with his song.
Yeah. Well, and it's
sorry.
I was going to say that is I'm obviously a very Davey song, but it's also a true testament. Like Davey really knowing how to hit his mark. His musical theater background is
absolutely
clearly at play because
that little umbrella flip.
Yeah,
like how badass is that?
Right.
Because I mean, have you ever tried to flip an umbrella? They don't have any balance. You know, and he's just
top heavy.
I'm not granted. They probably had some sort of stage umbrella that was weighted, but still, but it's an umbrella. You know, and he just like flips it, catches it.
Can't get mine open out of the car.
Yeah. Yeah, but so after the scene, you get another great line in the movie when he walks out and he sees Frank Zappa with a cow for some reason.
Because why not?
And he's like, that song is pretty white, man.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And Frank Zappa was actually always a big supporter of the Monkees. He was a big fan of what they were doing. Always had been. So he loved, and he hated critics. So he was like, as soon as critics hated them, he was like, well, they can't be all
bad. I love
that.
Those guys.
Yeah, he's like, and I love them. So then you get the scene with the cop and the step dancers doing the drill team again.
Yeah.
Which was weird.
Yeah.
And then just goes along with everything else.
Yeah. And then Davey goes in the bathroom and he opens the medicine cabinet and sees a big giant eyeball. I don't know why there's a medicine cabinet in a public restroom, but that's probably
That's
the least weird thing in the movie.
I'm telling you, there's a giant eyeball in there.
Yeah. And then it's also an interesting little nod when Peter comes in, he's whistling. I don't know if you noticed, he was whistling Strawberry Fields.
Yes, he was.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. They probably would have had to pay for that if anybody ever saw this thing.
Yeah. I know. I was like, hey, huh? Is there like a limit to how many notes, bud?
Yeah, but he's clearly whistling Strawberry Fields. So then at this point, Davey disappears and the cop does his weird little dance.
Yeah.
Like, which, like, fair enough.
Okie dokie.
And then we get the cop's dream. When it gets starts to get very surreal.
I don't remember this part.
Yeah. Oh, is this when it gets weird?
This is when it starts to get weird.
Oh, okay. This
but,
is a,
but this is another, like, end joke where, like, they want, they kidnap Mike and they want him to go to this birthday, they stay with his birthday party. And he's like, everybody disappears on him. He's trying to find people. And he's got this great line where he's like, he's trying to threaten them into coming back.
Right.
And he's like, you know, you better come back. He's like, I'll tell them all about us. You think they think we're plastic now, man. Wait till I get done.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's pretty cool.
And he's the one who outed them to the press as not playing their instruments. That kind of started what is referred to as the Palace Revolt, when they stood up to Kirshner and threatened to kick his... like
do their thing.
Like, literally threatened to hurt him physically.
Oh.
Yeah, and Mike famously threw a punch and, like, just missed his head, and it went through the drywall, and he was like, next time that'll be your face. And that was after they had just handed him each a check for like $100,000 from royalties.
That's so weird.
He was like, I don't want your money, I want to play an instrument.
I just saw a meme of from the drummer from the Stones.
Yeah.
Where he tells a story where he's like, so he's sitting in his hotel room, there's a knock at the door, and it's just like an assistant. He said, Mick wants to see his drummer downstairs right now. So the guy's like, right on. So he closes the door, puts on his clothes, goes downstairs, knocks on Mick's door, and immediately punches Mick in the face and says, I'm not your drummer, you're my lead singer.
Yeah, you're my
and
singer.
Walked out. and that's like just stories like that where it's like, shut up.
Yeah.
Like, you're not as important as you think.
It's like I started to research that story to see if it was true, and I'm
is
like,
Charlie Watts?
I'm just going to believe that it's true.
I think that's the drummer from the Stones.
Wow, that seems so unlike him because he's always been just this very.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Yeah, see,
that's why I didn't look it up.
I mean, the guy's like
don't ruin it.
He's
for
like
me.
A metro. No, no, no. I mean, he's
too
like
great
a
of a story.
He's like a metronome.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, like he's so emotionalist. He's always been.
That's how the drummers were back.
Doesn't
then.
Have no. to.
Ringo's the same way.
You have the two most insane front men you could have at that point in a band. Like the drummer's like, yeah, man,
yeah,
I'm just gonna play drums.
Yeah, you need some.
Some little calming agent
within the storm. Yeah. So then we get, do I have to get this all long title and then subtitled, do I have to do this all over again, which is our second Peter song. And then Mike's got a great scene where he like rails against everybody for abducting him to go to this birthday party. And he's like, that's not how you do it, you know? And he gives his whole speech, and that might be my favorite line in the whole movie after he like just belittles them for doing this. And they're all just shocked that he would be so, you know, and he turns around. And he's like, and I'll tell you another thing. The same thing goes for Christmas. And then you get this really weird scene where like the guy like is like having a stroke in front of us and talking.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, and then has another like pretty memorable line from the movie with son. Don't never, but never make fun of no cripple.
Yeah.
And it's very odd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the point of the movie where I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, ooh.
Yeah. So
that's where it veered into like El Topo or Holy Mountain. Like,
yeah.
Way into
just
like,
really
what
starts,
the hell?
Yeah.
Right.
So then you
that
get,
was my what the hell moment.
Yeah.
So it took a while. Like, my threshold
was you
hard.
Made it far.
I got to the mermaids. And I was like,
what are we
that
doing?
That was the moment where I was like, oh, man.
She doesn't have a thingamajig. So then we get the guru. Yeah. And he gives a speech. We were speaking of beliefs and conditioning. All beliefs can be said to me. I could do it.
We know.
And so an interesting thing about this speech, when I was in high school, I went to Catholic schools. I'm not Catholic, but I went to Catholic schools because the public schools where I lived were so bad. And
nothing's changed.
No, nothing has changed. I was in the Ferguson Florissant School District. Yes, that Ferguson. And so the religion teacher I had my senior year was this kind of weird, like hippie social justice type Catholic religion teacher. And he would just spout this crazy wackadoodle BS that just made no sense. Like, and I'm like, at some point I'm like, I don't really think what you're saying is Catholic anymore. And I'm not Catholic, so I don't care. Like, I'll just tell you what you want to hear so I can get an A in the class. But right. like, I don't know what we're doing here anymore. And so we had to write this paper about some sort of philosophy or whatever is applied to whatever. And so, and it was short. It only needed to be like one page.
Right.
That's the kind of teacher he was. Right. So I transcribed this speech on the paper.
Okay.
And I took, and then Peter kind of recycles it with some extra stuff later. So I took the two and merged them and transcribed them, the beliefs and conditioning speech, and turned it in straight face. Didn't reference the monkeys or where it was from. Just, it was an act of plagiarism. It was a blatant act of plagiarism.
Yeah,
but
we know you're a plagiarizer.
But it served a higher purpose. So I felt justified and turned it in, got an A.
Wow.
And I was like, you just proved everything I ever thought about you.
And you just undid all of your education now. Everything is a sham.
Everything is a sham.
Everything is a sham.
Everything is a sham and a damn dirty lie. So, at least in religion classes. Yeah.
I had a religion teacher try to explain to me the connections between Star Wars and God. And I was like, I mean, I'll listen to you. I love Star Wars.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Cool.
You're dumb, but that's fine.
I haven't heard that one before.
You won't ever again.
Okay, where were we at? So they invented the suicide girls. Get this girl.
Yeah, right.
And then Peter,
that was another weird one.
Yeah.
That was like, I was like, I mean, I don't mind this scene.
Yeah.
Because it's got a girl in a bikini.
Yeah, she was
and
doing okay
she
for
was,
herself.
She was a pretty lady.
I love the like later when they cut back and he's holding her like she had jumped and Mike, they're betting on whether she's going to jump and Mike's holding her. And like she's got this look on her face like, how did this happen? It's and she doesn't never not have that look. She holds it for the entire take, and it's
she does
just the eye shifting. It's great. It's little,
he's paying out the bet.
So
it's clear around this time of the movie that they were just like shooting wherever they could around
on the lot.
On the
right,
lot.
Right,
like,
right.
Can we use that building? We got a girl in a bikini.
Sure. Why not?
Okay.
So Peter's very confused, and now they end up back in the box. They end up in this black box, and what's interesting, some monkeys' backstories. The monkeys actually had a box like this that they were kept in during the series because they would make so much noise in their trailer. They built a black box for them, and they would go in this. They would keep them in this box where they would basically just get stoned.
Yeah.
And they had a light for each monkey, and so like if the red light went on, then that meant Davy, and that means they needed them. If red and green, then that means Davy and Mickey, and so they would just sit in this box until their lights would come on, and then they would.
It's the original hot box.
Yeah, so they really did have a box. Like they're all sort like that's what I mean when this movie's like one big end joke.
Right.
So Davy decides he's going to break them out of the box, and he goes on a one man killing spree, getting them out of the box, and they go through this whole big Byzantine thing only to end up right back in the box, which I think is kind of a metaphor for this movie and for what they felt like their careers were like.
No matter how hard
like,
we try to get out of this box,
they're always going to be the monkeys.
So this
which
is a big action scene when they start like fighting.
It's as close as you're going to get.
I mean, this was in this movie, this was like the most action. Like, they're like fighting people and getting them like they're falling off of walkways and stuff.
Yeah.
Like he punches them off a walkway or something like that. But I will say it was really funny. So my 6-year-old son watched a lot of this movie with me. Like he was coming and going, just walking by. Like, what are you watching? First, he walked
dad's
by.
Dad's like, I don't know.
Yeah. First, he walked by and he goes, this movie's so weird. And then he comes back and, you know, and he watched it for a little bit and he goes, this is the weirdest movie ever. And then he walks by right before that scene and Davey punches through the box and starts fighting people and he goes, whoa, now that is cool. That's what he said, literally, he thought that was cool. He goes, no, now that is cool.
That's funny.
So
I forgot. They're back in the box, and then Peter explains it all, and then that's what sets off Davy's rampage, because he ends with the same line about, I know nothing. And he was like, well, then you're wasting my time. So he goes on his 3-state killing spree, and they end up only to lead them back into the box.
Right.
It gets a little Blazing Saddles at this point.
Yeah,
you know?
I can see
this. Yeah, with this running around the studio lot and everybody from the film is kind of chasing them.
Yeah.
And so they get dropped into the desert.
That's my shooting hand.
Yeah, and then they end up back on the studio lot, and then they end up in a dune buggy chase with a giant Victor Mature. It's a little sad to see them driving a car that's not the Monkey Mobile.
Yeah.
Knocking along.
I wonder why they didn't do that.
I think that because they just didn't want to bring in a piece from the show.
Okay.
And my other theory is they didn't own the rights to their own logo.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering, I mean, to make this movie and do the things they did, like, this had no involvement from the people involved with the show,
I think,
right?
I believe the budget on the movie was like $750,000, which for 1968...
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of weed.
Yeah. it was mostly weed. It was mostly weed.
Don't get me wrong.
Who owned the show, though? Who got them together? Like, who...
NBC was aired the show, and it was produced by Cole Gems.
Okay.
So the same people that were doing, I think, like Gidget and stuff like that.
So like when this movie came out, were they okay with it? With them doing it? I don't understand. Like,
I think at this point,
already on the outs,
it was
though.
Unraveling. Okay. And I think they were such a nightmare for the network at that point, that they were just like, whatever, because they had one thing left with all four of them that aired, that came out after this, and it was called 33 and a Third Revolutions Per Monkey. It was an hour long, like, variety show type special. It's really weird.
Why am I not surprised?
And the network was so done with them at this point that it only aired once, and they aired it opposite the Oscars. So they knew nobody would watch it, and then they could go, you're clearly not popular anymore.
Yeah.
Go away.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So
there's a wrestling reference that I can make in there, but I'll let it go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've already bombarded them with comic books.
Right.
They're in the dune buggy, they're running around, and then the dune buggy, they end up back at the bridge. Yeah. We're back at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And they run through
something makes sense.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what that was about.
And they run through the because
everybody
the tape and the bridge opening ceremony, because mm-hmm. we're back at the beginning, because time is a flat circle, and and Mickey jumps off the bridge again. This time they all jump off the bridge, and they end up in a tank of water, in a box, in a truck, and Victor matures there.
That was cool. That was cool though. They're all swimming and everything, and then it pans out and they're in the box and they're driving away with them. Like there's
no escape.
Yeah. Was cool. I like, again, visually and like a lot of the stuff they did like that, really cool. It was just so disjointed. I had trouble understanding what was happening it meant, but I liked it.
That was purposeful. You know,
like
there's a quote from Jack Nicholson where he talks about how it's his favorite rock and roll movie because it was the anti rock and roll movie.
Right.
And he's like, and it looks like it's completely jumbled and about nothing. And he's like, and that's not easy to achieve.
No.
And it's not. And I thought this was great. I found the original review of the movie Head from the New York Times.
Oh, wow.
And
that's awesome.
So. And this also shows you, it's really because it's in the present tense, right? I mean, it's in the past tense,
because
we're not 1968. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I didn't.
But it was written
from all the weed that I smoked trying to watch this movie.
You got a contact high from this movie, right? So, but because it came out in this was written in the 60s, it really gives you a view into what people felt about the Monkees in real time, right?
Sure.
So, the reviewer said, and I was going to tell you the name of the review, but I don't know, because there's two reviews here and it doesn't tell you who wrote which one, but I think it probably lists them chronologically for how the reviews are posted. So if that was true, it was written by Renata Adler.
Okay.
Whoever that is.
Yeah.
And Renata says, I don't know if it's guy or girl, so says, Head, which opened yesterday at the Studio Cinema and Greenwich Theaters, which might be the only two theaters in America playing the film, might be a film to see if you have been smoking grass, or if you like to scream at the Monkees, or if you are interested in what interests drifting heads and hysteric high school girls. I'm thinking this isn't going to be a rave review.
I think you're right.
And who would like to keep score for me?
I'll do it.
We need a little bell.
Yeah.
So just
for what?
Keep score every time they mention marijuana.
Got it.
Okay, so we're already at one.
Ding. One. Yeah, ding.
There you go. Dreadfully written by Jack Nicholson and directed by Bob Rafelson, who, with Bert Schneider, created the Monkees as a singing group. The movie is nonetheless of a certain fascination in its joining of two styles. Pot.
Ding.
And advertising. The special effects, playing with perspective, focus, dimension, interstices? I've never seen it as a plural. symmetry, color, logic, pace are most accessible to marijuana.
Ding.
The use of prepackaged stars gives the movie a kind of brand name respectability, like putting Jim Dooley on display in a hashish crowd.
Ding.
And we'll count it.
Yeah, that counts.
The Monkees, who are among the least talented contemporary music groups,
wow,
and know it.
Dang.
That's pretty harsh.
Ooh, yeah. Just breaking it off in you. Are most interesting for their lack of similarity to the Beatles. Going through Arisat's Beatles songs and jokes and motions, their complete lack of distinction of any kind, the fact that fame was stamped on them by hucksters as it might have been on any nice four random, utterly undistinguished boys, makes their performance modest and almost brave.
Wow. Wow.
I will say
this is how I felt about Eat, Pray, Love.
But people don't write reviews like this anymore.
No, they work very hard and they aren't any good. This keeps them less distant from their own special fans than the Beatles or, say, Bob Dylan and the Beach Boys are. They do not have to bridge the distance of talent or style.
Wow. I mean, this is
like, this is just hateful.
Yeah.
This is just like.
No, it is so strange, though, because you don't get reviews like this anymore. No. You get, like, they kind of be like, it's not the greatest thing in the world. You may not want to check
it out.
It's
funny. People talk about how mean the internet is. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Look at this gal. The New York Times
Renata, whatever your name is.
Just trolled them.
Yeah. Because it's written well.
Yeah. Right. Says, there are some funny moments, and this is the part of the review that I find utterly fascinating. There are some funny moments. An old joke about a regiment of Italian soldiers surrendering to a single man, a policeman posing girlishly before a mirror, a scene in which the boys are cast as dandruff in the hair of a giant Victor Mature, a war scene in which Ray Nitschke of the Green Bay Packers keeps senselessly tackling a GI, an attack on a Coke machine, a breaking up of the film set, a nice transportation of a transposition of the Columbia Pictures logo. So I hated this movie except for 97% of the film. What the holy hell?
This movie's awful.
Except for all the great 3%. Parts.
Yeah.
This is, there are some ugly scenes, too. Mock fights in which Sonny Liston badly beats one of the monkeys about the face. Jesus Christ, based on the first part, I thought that would be your favorite part of the movie. Right. When one of them gets punched in the face, you hate him so damn much. Renata. We don't like you, Renata.
Yeah. Renata's probably dead at this point.
Yeah, very likely. But it will be interesting to see, and this is where Renata... proves her worth.
Okay.
Because I find this last paragraph very fascinating. He or she, maybe a she, probably, says, but it will be very interesting to see if the underlying fusion works, if taking essentially subversive styles, as in other pot films, such as Revolution and You Are What You Eat, and covering them with famous mediocrities assures their success. The aesthetic marijuana world is bound to come out importantly in films one way or another. This sort of movie may be the testing ground.
Wow.
And we never referenced, but in the diner scene, like, you for a brief second when Peter does his thing about not wanting to hit the girl. And,
right.
And Jack Nicholson wanders in. Dennis Hopper wanders in costume from Easy Rider.
Right. Sure.
Were they filming this at the same time?
Apparently, because he was in costume.
He was in full Dennis Hopper gear.
Yeah. And so when she says this may be...
that's just how Dennis Hopper looked.
I was going to say, it might have been his look.
This movie may be a testing ground. This movie was absolutely a testing ground.
It absolutely was.
So even... I mean, gotta give Renata credit for all of her hatred of the monkeys and of this movie that she kind of sort of liked.
Yeah, her assessment of the movie is pretty spot on.
Yeah.
She just hates the monkeys.
Right. Yeah. But it's like... But she was absolutely right. Like, the marijuana and the hippie drug culture was about to make a profound mark on cinema.
Right.
And it was going to be by these guys, and it was going to be about 35 minutes later.
Yeah.
Like, because this is the crew that went on to do Five Easy Pieces the Marvin Gardens and you know, I mean, just Postman Always Rings Twice. And I mean, they just, they were very influential in independent cinema. And it all started with this film, whether you want to admit it or not.
Six was your count.
Six. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Six.
It's funny.
Marijuanas.
Six marijuanas.
You mentioned that you saw this on a double feature with Hard Day's Night. Although it would have been. I think if he would have had this paired up with help.
Yeah, it would have been
this.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been that far apart.
No, they really wouldn't.
You know, it's like you put it up against Hard Day's Night, which in its
Hard Day's Night was like the innocent Beatles.
Innocent Beatles, but you know, almost too, you know, sly for people to understand.
Right.
I mean, it was also deconstructive.
Absolutely.
And also, you know, playing against type, but nobody was really quite aware.
Right.
And it was also, it had very like highbrow wit to it that people weren't expecting. So it goes over a lot of people's heads.
Yeah.
Versus like you throw Help on there or, oh God, Magical Mystery Tour. Ooh. But you throw those on there.
You think this is a muddled mess. Go watch Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, you throw those on there and it's like they're like really close. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that like
Dan just got his video recovered.
Yeah.
There you go. Any of those.
Yeah.
Any of those would work. Yeah. 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 Oh God, Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, it's a Beatles movie.
It was a Beatles movie.
It was a cartoon,
kind of,
Yellow Submarine. It was
so
all
Yellow Submarine.
Well, there was Yellow
like,
Submarine, and then there was Magical Mystery Tour, which was just sort of like
together. Yeah.
It's kind of very much like this.
Okay.
Although this is a little bit, I think,
purposeful.
Easier to swallow.
Yeah. And I feel like this was, they were trying to make it like that.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they necessarily were with Magical Mystery
Tour.
Yeah,
well, and it's funny because, like, you know, the monkeys basically having the revolt and kicking out Kirshner.
Yeah.
The Beatles didn't do that. I mean, the Beatles did the same thing, is that at a certain point, they said, we don't want to keep touring to, you know, sold out theaters of screaming girls.
Right.
And what they
wanted to create musically couldn't be replicated live.
No.
Isn't that what Zeppelin kind of did?
They were always out there.
But I mean, didn't they get to a point where they were just kind of like, you know, we don't want to be a jukebox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because where they all just kind of like, I mean, they went out kind of on top.
Right.
But they all kind of said like,
well, except for one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna talk about that one.
But
no, you know what I'm saying? Like, they just got like, we can play Stairway to Heaven a million times.
Right.
But we don't want to.
Yeah.
So
we
just kind of walked away.
But it's interesting. Like, the monkeys actually kind of, you know, to Tom's point, is like, they did that earlier.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
I mean, a lot of this take on things, they predate so many people that have followed with this same kind of thing.
Sure.
You know? And they really don't get the credit they deserve for
And
that.
There's tons of artists that have done that. I mean, Marvin Gaye is a great example of, like, you know, he was set, and he's like, I don't want to get out there and shake my ass and be some sort of Frank Sinatra. You
right,
know?
Right,
like,
right.
He's like, I don't want to do that.
Well, until he needed the money, he was like, sexual healing? Don't mind if I do.
Well, a parody of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, like, at a certain, well, like, but his music, like, you know, well, yeah, sexual healing. But I mean, it's like, although at that point, like, there wasn't a lot of output anyway.
Tour
and
life.
He had the whole nasty divorce and had to do a whole album to pay for it.
Yeah.
So, but you think about, like, going from, like, his early stuff to, like, what's going on. It's like, whoa, where'd that come from?
Right.
Yeah. Because it was there, and they just weren't allowed to do it.
Right. Gotcha. I gotcha.
And like, even those early Monkees albums, it's like, that's why those standout songs, you're like, that's different.
Yeah. I mean, Last Train to Clarksville is technically about a guy going off to Vietnam.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, that nobody was talking about.
I always loved that.
It was hidden, but it was
there. You see we see it now because we know about it. And maybe not even then, I'm sure, like, you didn't know the underlying story that they were trying to tell. Like, Last Train to Clarksville could be a pretty, you know.
It can go either way.
Completely meaningless.
You don't have to take it that way, but once you know where Clarksville's at and what people did there,
correct.
You know.
You know what the score is, yeah.
So,
but, yeah, no. I mean, it's not, they're not Milli Vanilli. I keep,
no.
I'm sorry if there's a Milli Vanilli podcast out there.
There isn't.
No, don't worry about it.
Aren't they dead?
Well, one of them
is.
Yeah,
But it's one of those things.
The other
one
just did an episode of The Moth telling that story.
Yeah, it's just weird because it's
what?
They lumped into, you know, like, oh, they didn't do anything. It's like,
right.
No, they did a lot.
And they didn't at first, and they stood up and said no.
Yeah.
And then they did stuff.
Right,
and
right,
like,
right, right.
And they've been fighting that battle ever since.
It really is ultimately very unfair because they did do the right thing, and they never got the credit for it that they deserve.
I don't get why that was such a small part. I mean, albeit it was the first part where they were found, but it was such a small part, and then they've gone on to still this day performing and touring and doing things.
Yeah.
Like, why is that little part of their creation what defines them?
Because Stone Magazine hates them.
Well, yeah.
Because Jan Werner, Stone Magazine hates them.
Yeah. Why, though? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, because he came from that era. He was there and watched it happen in real time and just holds a grudge.
Oh.
And even though he'll put, you know,
Miley Cyrus.
Right,
or
on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine or whatever, but the monkeys are a problem. Like, it's just, you know, when they did their reunion tour, they were, in the Reader's Choice, they were voted the best comeback tour of 1986, and Rolling Stone also deemed them the worst comeback tour of 1986.
Wow.
Because they just hate them that much.
That's the kind of journalism I find despicable.
Yeah.
Well,
it's like,
I mean, Rolling Stone hated, they hated Led Zeppelin and they hated Van Halen. I mean, it's like, to be hated by, they hated Queen. So to be hated by Rolling Stone,
it's kind of
a
badge of honor.
Yeah. But they finally turned the corner and had to admit that those bands were good. And they're finally starting to turn the corner on the monkeys. That last tour with Davey, they finally started to acknowledge that, like, hey, this band's actually pretty good. And then when Davey died, they wrote a lot of really nice things, which I'm glad they didn't write bad things, but they could have written nothing or just done a real small blur. But they wrote a very nice piece. And then when Mike came back, they wrote a very nice piece, really kind of aggrandizing his place in the history of the creation of country rock, which is which is just
can't fight it.
You can't calculate enough how much that man contributed to that genre of music. The version of the Eagles' Seven Bridges Road, he created that arrangement. It was sung by another band, and then another band covered it. But the original version sounds nothing like what you're familiar with. The cover sounds exactly like what the Eagles did, and he produced the album that is the version.
Did they only do that live?
Yeah, I think they just
did that in the studio.
Yeah,
did they?
Just live. Yeah,
okay.
So.
Yeah. I love that song.
But anyway, so that's our episode, our special Zilch episode. So thanks to Ken and Sarah Clark and all the people over at Zilch for letting us come on.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. And we'll go around the table, and everybody on our show can tell everybody where to find them.
Hey, this is Dan. You can find me on Twitter at DanGraney67, GRANEY.
This is Joe. You can also follow me on the Twitter at JoeyButts, BUTTS21.
I'm Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And I am Tom O'Keefe, the one who loves the monkeys the most.
Wait till we do our Superman podcast.
Yeah, do we do a Superman podcast? Yeah, then I'll sit over quietly.
What podcast do I get? I'll come up with some.
Yeah, you can come up with some. Yeah.
You can get some Wes Anderson podcast.
There we go.
I'll take the Star Wars one.
You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. If you would like to check out the show, you can follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/Real Spoilers. Or on Twitter, at Real Spoilers. If you have questions or you want to chastise us for some piece of monkey trivia that I probably got wrong at some point, and you're going to be like, you're not a real fan.
You're not a real fan.
You didn't know when the show got canceled. You can do that at realspoilers@reviewstl.com. And that's real with two E's, like a movie reel. See what we did there? Or you can check out our website, realspoilers.com. How about that? So while we're also on iTunes. So go there and subscribe if you like, and you can hear us do this sort of stuff with all sorts of different movies. There's plenty of them that we've done. At this point, we've done like 140 episodes, something like that. So we've done pretty much all the major movies in the last 2.5, 3 years.
So we'll say we started with Man of Steel.
We started with Man of Steel, and we still haven't moved on. So we still argue about it to this
day. Just wait. We got another few months, and then we can go back at it
again. It's almost time for me to prove you all wrong.
No. You're never going to prove that Man of Steel was good.
But it's going to be good.
You're just going to prove that they decided that we were right, and they wrote their movie to apologize for
them. They fixed it.
But anyway, so we're at iTunes, and if you like us, feel free to rate and review us. We would greatly appreciate it. And once again, thanks to the cast of Zilch for letting us come on. And for Real Spoilers fans who listen to this show that are hearing this as just a regular Real Spoilers episode, let me point out that Zilch is a podcast that's a lot of fun. And if you're only going to listen to one, because I know that if you're not a Monkees fan, you're like, why would I listen to people talk about the Monkees for an hour? Like, that, I get that. The episode, I think it's episode 19, and they interview Marty Ross from the New Monkees. And I know that you're like, if I don't care about the Monkees, why would I care about the New Monkees? But that episode is just positively riveting to hear this man tell the story of being plucked from obscurity and returned there not too long after. And I don't mean that in a mean way, because I'm friends with Marty on Facebook and he's a super nice guy. But that story and the way he tells it of how they were primed to be the next Monkees, because Rafelson, Schneider, all those guys were involved with the launch of the New Monkees. So there was the same creative team behind it, and just the amount of hatred and vitriol that they got from the fans, and how that one moment they're going around doing the rounds on the Today Show, and the next moment they're taking their instruments back from them.
It's just
a fascinating story. So if you're only going to listen to one, I would recommend the one with Marty Ross from the New Monkees. It's a really fascinating story.
Very good.
Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate it. And until next time, save the Texas Prairie Chicken.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.